Juliet Dogcast Radio. If you like dogs, wherever you are in the world, we're the show for you. Hello and welcome to episode 73 of Dogcast Radio. Later in the show, we'll have the Dogcast Radio news and a fiction feature called Spirit. But before any of that, let's go straight to the focus of today's show, clicker training. What is it, how do you do it, and what can you achieve with it? There are many misconceptions about the method. So to clear all this up and get some advice from someone who really knows, I talked to Aaron Clayton from Karen Pryor Clicker Training. I've heard people say things that certainly don't match with what my understanding of clicking is. So first, I wanted to establish just what clicker training is.
It's several answers because, you know, it depends always on you know, where you sit. If you ask, you know, a scientist, clicker training is the use of positive operant conditioning with a marker signal. And, you know, from a just a real basic scientific standpoint, that's what it is. And most owners, that means, you know, dog owners, that would mean absolutely nothing to.
No.
So, so clicker training is really a way of communicating and developing a relationship with your dog who's in your life. And it's probably distinguished most clearly in people's minds because it is, you know, doesn't use any force and no punishment to create the environment, to create the behaviors, to create an obedient, to quote, quote unquote, what most pet owners think when they start, you know, they just want an obedient dog. And clicker training takes it at to a much higher level. An obedient dog is, everybody needs a dog that is in harmony and partnership with the house that you have. But most people sort of stop there, and clicker training brings it to the next level of relationship. And really, it's about bringing out the personality of the animal that's in your life. And most people know that, you know, labs have different personalities than German Shepherds and Papillons and all of that. But most real dog owners, you know, who have lived with a dog know that it's much deeper than that. The dogs actually have, you know, individual personalities that that your lab and my lab are not the same.
Mm.
They share some characteristics, but they're not the same. And certainly any rescue dog would be, you know, have a, who knows what kind of, you know, breed personality it would have. And clicker training is really a way of communicating and creating a two-way communication system with that, with your animal, so it can tell you what it wants and you can tell it what you want, and raise that level of communication to the point where you know, actually feel like the animal's personality is coming out, you're learning from it, and he's learning from you. And so that, in a nutshell, is clicker training, if we're moving away from the science.
Yes. Yes, please. I'm happy.
But it does have a side. But unlike, you know, every other dog training, you know, sort of quote-unquote system, which, you know, there really aren't systems of training because they really, it's been an apprenticeship. You know, so-and-so learned, you know, from the monks, and so-and-so learned from these people, and sort of our tradition of passing things down, most of which are myths and not scientifically based. You know, the fact that, you know, dogs are heavily pack animals because they're, you know, engaged, you know, because of the wolf. Well, that, you know, all of that's like, you know, has some basis in truth, but the implications of that connection are just way drawn out of proportion. And they're so far removed from the wolf that, you know, that this whole thing that you need to be dominant and be a leader, those are all myths. They're myths made, perpetuated by, because things being just handed down in an oral tradition. So clicker training, you know, is really a scientific basis of training based and grounded in how all living organisms learn. Not just animals, people. Every organism learns on the basis of, you know, operant conditioning, being reinforced for what works.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, if somebody hasn't, used a clicker or heard much about a clicker, how should they start to use a clicker with their dog?
How should they start? Well, let's talk about first of all what usually happens to people, because they go to a pet store and they see these little clickers by the counter maybe, and they pick them up and they click them at the dog and the dog head turns and they go, oh wow, this thing works. You know, it gets their dog's attention.
Yeah.
And of course it gets their dog's attention because it makes a unique sound and that's important. But that's not how it's used. So if someone's gonna pick up, you know, a clicker, they really should pick up a little pamphlet or a book or something that teaches them how to use it. Mm. And you know, before going and clicking it at their dog, they really want to understand that the clicker is used to mark the behavior that you like.
Yes.
So it marks the moment in time when the behavior happens. So if that head turn, if you're trying to get the dog to look at you and you call the dog's name, or if it just happens to look at you and you click, and then you provide some reinforcement for that to the animal, then now you've got the system. Now you've got just the basis of how the system works. You mark the behavior that you wanted, and then you provide some reinforcement. And, you know, every animal's a little different. Most dogs like some kind of food. So, you know, if your dog likes a pat in the head as reinforcement, that's great. But most animals are prey or food driven. So if you provide a little reinforcement, then the dog learns two things.
Yeah. Yeah.
I got reinforced, and the clicker's telling me what it is I got reinforced for.
Yeah.
And that's really why the marker's important, because it's very precise about telling the animal what it got reinforced for.
Yeah, yeah. It really speeds things up, doesn't it?
It does. You know, I always tell people, they ask, well, why, you know, why would I do, you know, click sharing? What's so special about it? And the speed of learning is number one. You know, the speed of learning is number one for me. It's just really cool. And then two is the precision with which you can teach behaviors. You know, if you wanted to teach your dog to lick his lips on your cue of yum, you know, how did you like that, Rover? Yum. And that means you have to basically catch, you know, that tongue flick.
Yeah.
You can't really do that with anything else, you know. So and that precision translates to not just, you know, cool little tricks, but to, you know, championship freestyle kind of moves that are very complicated. You know, freestyle being the dancing, you know, that people do to music with their dogs in these elaborate and really cool and kind of wonderful routines. You can't teach that kind of stuff without having, you know, the ability to precisely target.
Yeah.
And the third thing is really just this, the relationship change that you get when you begin to do this. It's really remarkable, the change in the dog's behavior, the change in your behavior, because you begin to look for things that you want to reinforce instead of looking for things that you're trying to stop.
Yes.
Does that make any sense?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So the thing is, I think the dog gets a very, as you say, positive reinforcement of what it's doing. So it's, if there's a behavior that is being ignored and you're not shouting or whatever it is, you know, then he's going to think, hang on, what can I do then to get that click?
Yeah, exactly. You're so right, Julie. That's exactly right. When the dog becomes, in a very short time, savvy, it all of a sudden starts figuring out, you know, starts saying, what can I do to earn that click and that reward?
Yeah.
But, you know, and it's, you know, people are always trying to, you know, crate train their dogs, you know, and it's like, you know, they will take their dogs, they'll make it stay in the crate, they'll, you know, they'll do almost anything. But, you know, the easiest way to crate train your dog and get it to love its crate is every time it goes near the crate, you know, reinforce it.
Yeah.
You know, for being in there.
Yes.
You know, first for going near it, and then you raise your own criteria for what you're going to reinforce. That's wonderful that you're near it. Now I'm going to reinforce you when you're in it or when you touch it. And then I'm going to reinforce you for in it, and then I'm going to reinforce you for staying in it. And so it's a very, very simple thing to catch on to. But we are, as a species, I think, very inclined to find fault or to try to stop things all the time. It's just how we are. You know, we criticize, and, you know, people tend to find fault. So when they start to do this with their dog, when they start to clicker train, it actually changes a lot of things, because they actually begin to look for things they can reinforce.
Mm.
And it might, if they're lucky, not just reinforce with their dog, but all of a sudden they might think about reinforcing things with their spouses or with their friends or in their interactions. It's much easier and so rewarding to actually find, to look for things to reinforce positively than it is to try to stop things all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And people do have, you know, we do all things that we want to stop, but the way that, if you're a clicker trainer, the way that you think about that is a little bit different. You know, you turn things on its head just a little bit, and you think, how can I create a behavior that's just about what I want, not what I don't want?
Mm-hmm.
So if I don't want my dog to be always at the dinner table begging, what is it actually that you want? Well, what you want is your dog maybe to lie down on its mat while you're having your meal.
Yeah.
So that change in perspective says, oh, okay, now I create a training plan to reinforce that behavior, lying down on the mat while we're at dinner, as opposed to trying to think about, how do we keep the dog away from the dinner table?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, and that's a very, you know, that's a very different mindset, but it's so powerful. You know,
yeah.
It's so powerful in terms of finding solutions.
Yeah, yeah. I also think that works for the dog so much better. I mean, we used it to stop our Labrador pulling on the lead, and we'd fought him and, you know, pulled back for about, over a year, and 10 minutes with a clicker, and he sort of got the idea, and they can get their head around, oh, you want me to do this? But it's very hard for them to get the idea of, oh, so don't do that. That's not a real dog concept, is it?
You know, that story is exactly right on, Julie. You know, we don't pretend to actually know, like, what goes on, you know, in the dog's head, whether they can get this or get that. But they certainly understand that, you know, what they're being reinforced for. Because the basic principle of any, for dog or anybody else, for learning is what gets reinforced will get repeated.
Mm.
And what's repeated will crowd out the stuff that you didn't want. Because it's impossible for him to both be near you, you know, walking loosely on his leash, and to be pulling at the same time.
Yes, yeah.
Those things are impossible. So if you are reinforcing walking loosely, then he'll do that more often, and then you'll have less pulling.
Yeah, yeah.
To the point where ultimately the only thing that he wants to do is to walk loosely, because he'll get reinforced every now and then.
Yeah.
And one of the myths of people who go look at clicker training, they look at a clicker, is they say, oh, well, hey, you know, I don't want to be stuck with this little device all the time. And I wouldn't either. You know, I probably haven't used my clicker in, you know, 3 years, because, you know, I'm not showing my dog. It's, you know, I'm not competing with it. It's a family dog. And I've taught him most things I need to teach him.
Yeah.
So once he's learned the behavior, you don't need the clicker. You still need to reinforce, right? A history of reinforcement is like a, you know, money in the bank.
Yes.
You know, you need to keep building that money in the bank.
Mm.
And so you need to reinforce, but you don't need to click once the behavior is reliably learned. We call it, you know, being on cue. Then you don't need that clicker to use anymore. You're still using the principles, but the clicker you only use to teach new things.
Yeah.
Or if you go to maybe you're going to a completely new environment and you feel like you want to be able to communicate very quickly.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, because we used a clicker with Buddy when he was, I don't know, say 6 to 18 months. And then, as you say, you've taught the behaviors that you need, and you don't need the clicker then. You know, he knows what you want him to do. You just give the command that you've taught, and he does it. And then we took up, as you said, you've mentioned, heel work to music. And there's these complicated, difficult movements that, how on earth am I going to convey to him that what I want him to do? And I spent a fortnight struggling, And then my teacher said, have you ever clicked with him? And I kind of, I sort of struck my forehead and went, yeah, I forgot that. And it was, we made, you know, we did everything we could have done in a fortnight in about two sessions, because it was suddenly that, oh, that's what you want me to do.
Right. And I bet you found not just the speed, but afterwards you found that, like, the recall.
Yeah.
You know, you've seen some really cool stories, but, you know, one of my favorites on the clickertraining.com is that there was a National Geographic trainer who, or I think the story was on National Geographic. I can't remember the affiliation of the trainer himself, but they had I think it was a jaguar or a cheetah that they had had in captivity, and they had trained, you know, using clicker training, and then they released it into the wild. And some very long time went by, a year or 18 months, something like that. And they went back into the wild, into the area where they radio transmitter, they knew it was around. Mm. And they had a very distinct, you know, recall, you know, a come cue for this animal.
Yeah.
And he used it. And out of the bush,
he
comes running, and then you can see the animal, you know, licking his trainer's face.
Right.
In the bush. The behaviors that are learned are really, really deeply learned.
Yeah.
And it's just now, and we didn't really have a terrific explanation from that, but one of the things that Karen is actually writing in this new book is the neurological basis for why that happens.
Mm, that would be interesting.
The neuroscientists actually have neural pathways for explaining now why it is that behaviors learned in this way are deeply learned.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think that part of it is with the clicker, it's not like you, as you say, you don't force the dog. The dog, you know, decides, okay, well, I'll try this then, and you get the click. And you're, oh, right, okay. I mean, for example, we have the Labrador. We also have a Bichon Frise. Completely different dog, different, you know, mentality, but different
Sure.
physically. And much, much harder to, you know, you can't push on you can't put much pressure on a little dog's bottom, you know, to make it sit or down.
Right.
And,
right.
you know, I could not get this Bichon Frise to lie down. And you can't sort of take the front legs. There's not the room. It's a different build of dog. And again, I used clicking with her. But with her, you know, I used more, okay, I'm going to teach you what the click means, but then I'm going to wait and you present a behavior. You know, and I love that.
Terrific!
Way.
You're an excellent trainer. In fact, that really should be clicker trainers would never use, you know, force. They would never put the dog's rump down, model the behavior, and then click that.
No.
Because that would be sort of ruining the, you know, this sort of bank of reinforcement that you've picked up.
Yeah.
And the dog, in fact, choosing to do the behavior is the best of, you know, both worlds.
Yeah.
You know, you get that, and when we. And so, the you know, a common question people ask, well, how do I train something that, you know, the dog won't do naturally or, you know, doesn't offer just up? And the word for that is called shaping, which is the scientific word is successive approximation. It's a way of thinking about the behavior in small increments and reinforcing those each of those increments, and over time, over those increments, the dog begins to do it. So if you're trying to teach your dog to spin, that might begin with simply clicking and reinforcing a head turn. Or it might begin clicking and reinforcing a right paw to the right. You know, the dog takes a step to the right.
Yeah.
And then you're building on that. So that, oh, I did that. You want me to turn to the, you want me to put my paw to the right? Fine. I put my paw to the right. Click, reinforce, click, reinforce, click, reinforce. Oh, I'm doing that regularly now. I've got that. Okay. I put my paw to the right. Nothing happens. No click, no reinforcement. What does the animal do? In 9 times out of 10 cases, the animal will try a more extreme version of what it has already been reinforced for.
Mm.
So that paw to the right, which now maybe has gone, you know, 4 or 5 inches to the right, becomes an 8-inch turn. to the right. Boom. You click and reinforce that.
Yeah.
And that's the process of shaping, which is just so rewarding for the dog and for the animal, because then the game is really on. Mm. Because now the animal's trying to guess, you know, yes. what it can do next. to earn some reinforcement.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and that's what you had with your Bichon Frise, you know, sort of going, okay, what can I do? What can I do?
Yes, yeah. And it was so, I mean, she's tiny, and it's very hard for me. I've been used to bigger dogs, and it's very hard for me to remember there is a little brain in that little head, you know. But as soon as the clicker came out, it was as clear as day there was a brain inside that head because of the things she was doing, you know, and that was incredible.
Well, we think that's what people will, you know, soon, that's what people are experiencing, but will also be, you know, documented scientifically in the same way that, you know, we use as people only a small percentage of our brain capacity. When you begin to work with the animal in this way, you'll go, oh my God, look at that personality. Look at what that animal can learn.
Yeah.
You know, and look at how the animal can problem solve.
Mm.
And that is what really blows people's minds, because they see just how underdeveloped most training measurements are on the animal.
Yeah.
You don't get to see most of that brain in action. You don't get to see it working, and to see it working and to see what the animal's capable of is just, you know, it's fascinating.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting you say that, because, as I say, I've been doing various things with Buddy, but one of the one we had not the most difficulty with, but the one that was difficult to teach was this heel work to music. And one of the problems I have with him, he's a Labrador, he just wants the food, So if I have a treat, you know, and I'm trying to make him do things, he's not thinking about what he's doing. He's just thinking, there's a treat in your hand, I want the treat. And as you say, he can't then remember, what did I do? You know, so to put the treats away, and I just have the clicker, and as soon as I've clicked, I go and get him a treat. But it just takes that sort of urgency away, and it clears his brain, it seems to, and then he can concentrate on what am I actually going to do to get the click that leads to the treat. But you know, it sort of clears his mind for him.
No, that's right on, and it's one of those things where I think commonly, I don't know, you know, in England, but certainly I think the same term is used, you know, it's sort of alluring, right? If you have the food and you're trying to use the food and it's in, you know, very visual sight.
Yes.
Then it can it becomes a distraction. A lot of people will use it to maybe, you know, teach. You're trying to teach a weave, you know, so
yes.
You may, you know, have the, you know, have the, you know, hold the food and the dog goes through it. But it does slow down the learning, that luring, and you can still use it and it's still positive. There's nothing, you know, there's no punishment associated with it. But that alone definitely slows down the learning, because it's not as conscious about what it has done in order to earn the reinforcement.
Definitely.
If you click and lure, you know. So it's like the way many people will teach a whip. It's like, well, teach it to target your hand first, or teach it to target a target stick, or, you know, use something that it's learning to target. And then as it's got your target, then you can click and reinforce. And that's very different, because it's not really focused on the food. It's focused on, you know, the action that it's doing.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
Going towards the target.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you're exactly right on that, on the difference between just using food alone or even using food with a clicker. It's definitely better than, you know, choke chains and
yes.
prong collars.
Yeah.
But you don't get that same speed, you know, of learning.
This interview continues later in the show. A dog that is indoors to be let out implores. You let him out, and what then? He wants back in again. Ogden Nash.
You're listening to Dogcast Radio on www.dogcastradio.com.
And now, 2 Minute Fiction. Spirit, written and read by Julie Hill. At first, the spirit of the wolf and the spirit of the human were separate. There was no intertwining. In fact, there was distrust, even enmity between them. Young humans were taught to fear wolves. Young wolves were shown how to avoid humans. Yet in the spirit of the human, there was a need for an unknown something. In a world so raw and full of danger, the human was lacking a hunting partner and a protector. In the spirit of the wolf, too, there was a longing for an unknown something, a connection not yet made, a whisper, a look, a caress. Yet his love for his freedom kept him aloof and wild. Then it happened. Hunger drove the wolf to forget his fear, or hunters realized the wolf's potential, or abandoned wolf cubs were rescued and brought up in a human pack. It does not matter how, it matters only that it did happen. In the beginning, the spirit of the wolf and the spirit of the human walked uneasily together. Their tracks were parallel. The human had discovered a hunter with an efficient nose and a quick eye, as well as an effective guard with a ferocious growl and a loud bark. The wolf had found a provider of food, of warmth, and of shelter. Both were pleased, and once forged, the bond would not be broken. As time passed, the wolf moved closer to the heart of the human family. He lay nearer the fire. He watched over the children. He slept at the human's bedside. He walked at the human's heels. He dwelt in the human's heart, and the human dwelt in his. Their tracks merged. The wolf became the dog. The leg up the wolf had given the human meant life became easier for them both. The dog learned to play. He was transformed into countless appearances, sizes, and shapes. Still, within each varied canine breast, a heart as staunch as ever beat. And still, he held his favoured place in the human heart. And now, in a world full of danger, with so many wrong turns to take, the spirit of the human feels a need for unquestioning love, faithful companionship, and unerring support. And in the spirit of the dog, too, there is a longing for an unknown something. To run, to hunt, to be free again. Yet his love of the human keeps him tame and faithful. What share we most, we two together? Smells and awareness of the weather. What is it makes us more than dust? My trust in him, in me, his trust. Siegfried Sassoon, Man and Dog. Erin had talked about what clicker training is and how fast it gets results. I have used it for heel work to music, but can you use it for agility and obedience and so on?
Oh, yeah. You know, we've been using it in all of those fields. In agility, it's probably extremely even more popular. Obedience comes from, you know, agility has been around sort of as a major activity with dog owners for a shorter period of time. Obedience has a big, you know, long history. Mm. And we wrote a book, Click Training for Obedience, authored by Morgan Spector and published by us a number of years ago, which goes through how to click a train, you know, the entire obedience regimen. But in agility, it has probably even become more popular because they sort of had a lower tradition, and also because the dogs that are using it are just, you know, going gangbusters.
Yeah.
And one of the, you know, and it's used in agility, is sometimes people will say, well, I use it to teach just the most difficult stuff. And it always makes me laugh because if you're using it for the most difficult stuff, think how well it would work on the easy
yes,
stuff.
Yes, yeah. Oh.
And, yeah, it's marvelous. For the one of the core concepts we talked actually at Clicker Expo, which is our big conference twice a year, one of the things that we have been focusing people on is this concept, and it's a very sort of advanced concept, but it's this concept of actually what people don't realize is that the cues, you call them commands, but we call them, you know, cues, the cues for the next behavior, going from the tunnel to the teeter-totter, let's say, the cue for the teeter-totter, if it follows the tunnel, is actually reinforcing the previous behavior.
Yeah, yeah.
And because it all leads to goodness at the end.
Yes.
Right? And if you've trained everything, you know, properly, and it's not complicated, but it is kind of different than how people really think, it's, you know, there's all, it's all rewarding for the dog in the end. And so your cues that you give along the way, if they're properly trained and properly given, they become so powerful, the cues themselves. So now we're away from the idea of using a clicker. We use the clicker to train all those behaviors, but once they're learned and we're learning them in a sequence, the cues themselves become reinforcing. And it's only your listeners that care an awful lot about competition that will probably want to learn more about that.
Oh, but
it's exactly the same of like, how do the dolphins and the orcas, you know, how do they learn these complex routines? Right? And in agility, in some ways, it's one of the toughest challenges, because the challenge of the agility, of course, that it is different every time you go, right?
Yes.
The
yeah.
sequence is different. And, but, you know, even in those animal shows, they actually vary the sequence of the behaviors, because otherwise it gets boring and
yeah.
you do lose the training. So the training is exactly the same. You know, the challenges are the same. And these long, complex sequences of behaviors are really taught exceptionally well with clicker training, the most powerful way to teach it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's as you say, it's a system that works so well when you use it, you know, properly. Do you feel that we've sort of busted all the myths and misunderstandings that we need to, or is there anything else that you'd like to clear up?
Well, I think it's mostly for the competition level and the obedience level and all that, there's lots and lots of myths that, you know, are still out there. For the pet owner, you know, the biggest myths are, A, you know, I use the thing like my remote control,
yeah.
that I click it at the dog and it goes on and off. That's not the way, you know, that would start us off on the wrong foot. And second, that you're sort of stuck with the clicker, you know, for your life.
Yeah.
Second, that you need some special coordination, you know, to do this. You absolutely do not. You don't need any kind of special coordination. There's an element of timing, but, you know, seven-year-olds, you know, can do this. So
yeah.
it's definitely true that, you know, that adults can pick it up, you know, rather easily. And it's so funny about kids when they learn to do this, because they're, you know, they often haven't, at like 7 years old, you know, they haven't been through these school systems and everything, where they're often sort of always told what they're doing wrong instead of
yes.
not often to know what they're doing right. So they, you know, at 7 years, they come at it, and they absolutely get this idea of just reinforcing what the dog has done right. It takes them no time to lose, you know, the old perspective. They really have the perspective right away. It's wonderful to see kids with this.
Yeah, yeah. As you say, nobody's sort of said, oh, you won't be able to manage this. They haven't got that mindset, have they? No.
No. And I guess the final myth is that just because people call themselves positive trainers or clicker trainers does not really mean that they are. You know, people need, if they want to understand this, they really do need to investigate and find out a little more about how people do it, because the term has become in some ways so popular that there are trainers who combine punishment and using a clicker, and they are not doing clicker training.
Mm.
You know, that is not how it's done. And, you know, there's a great discussion with clicker solutions that people, you know, on a Yahoo group, people can join that. They can go to greatdogtrainers.com, which has a list of people who have graduated Karen's program. And so they've, you know, been through a very rigorous set of courses and standards for, you know, to uphold the standards of how to teach this. And there are wonderful trainers out there all across who actually are doing it right. But there are people who hold up the card and say, yes, I do this too, you know, just another quiver in my basket. Mm. But, the, you know, quiver in my, a quill in my, what do you call that?
I know. The arrow. It's arrow in my quiver, isn't it? I think.
An arrow in my, thank you. You know, that they have it as just another tool. But
yeah.
It's really hard. You know, that's really not the, those people generally are not understanding and practicing it the way that it'll be easy for them to teach you. You know, easy for them to teach someone else how to do it.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that's actually, you know, pretty easy, you know, that you can easily pick up.
Yeah.
You know, and it's really only when you need to get to that next stage of learning that it's good to have someone helping you around. But you can pick it up, get a little, and, you know, get a little bit of instruction. There's tons of free stuff on clickatraining.com. I mean, a whole library of materials, downloads, free videos, all kinds of stuff to help educate people. So there's tons of resources out there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we've talked about how people can sort of use it, and I imagine it is extremely useful, you know, if you are competing at, you know, at a high level with your dog, or competing at all. But, I mean, how we got into it was just teaching Buddy tricks. And once you've got your dog to do something that you can then show people and say, hey, look what he'll do, it's addictive, because you start thinking, what can I teach him now? What can I? And it's just a magic wand, I think.
It is the best, you know, advertising, you know, for it is always the really well-behaved dogs. I'm always, you know, walking my dog in at the center of my little town in Massachusetts. And, you know, it's a big 80-pound strapping, you know, black lab who's walking loosely on his leash and is calm, you know, and never gets upset or, you know, and that's just, he's been that way since, because he was trained this way, like as soon as he was done whelping, and it creates this very calm, lovable, you know, personality, and people are like, well, I can't do that with my, I have a lab, but I couldn't do that with my dog. How did you get that? You know, how did that happen? And so it is absolutely the best advertising is those well-behaved dogs.
If you would like to have a well-behaved dog, or you want to use clicking to improve your heel work to music, agility or obedience training, you can find out more at clickatraining.com, which we have a link to on the Dogcast Radio site. Happy clicking! My home is a haven for one who enjoys the clamour of children and ear-splitting noise from a number of dogs who are always about and who want to come in and, once in, to go out. Ralph Witherspoon, My Dumb Friends.
Hello and welcome to the Dogcast Radio News Desk. I'm Kate.
And I'm Nick. In episode 71 of Dogcast Radio, we focused on the dangers dogs face from the heat of summer and simple steps to keep your dog safe. However, it seems in summer there are many other ways dogs can get into trouble.
Insects love the heat and can pose a serious risk to our dogs. One young pit bull in Tampa, Florida, was recently stung to death when her owner let her into the backyard. As the temperature rises, so does the incidence of rattlesnake, mosquito and spider bites, stings from wasps and yellowjackets, and even attacks from fire ants. Fleas and ticks can also thrive in the summer and make life very uncomfortable for our four-legged friends. And it's not just the insect world we have to be wary of. Some smaller dogs have been hurt by a kick or stamp from a deer.
Many plants, such as foxgloves, are poisonous, and it's worth a visit to the ASPCS website to check out their advice. Cocoa mulch spread in the garden may smell delicious to your dog, but the theobromine it contains is potentially fatal to them. Dogs may also be attracted to antifreeze or lighter fluids, but they are also toxic, as are some pesticides and weed killers. It's also worth checking your dog's fur after a day out and removing any seeds that have become snagged or stuck in their coat, paws or ears. Grooming is extra important in the summer, but there can be dangers in a grooming parlour.
If you do use a groomer, ask if your dog can be hand or air dried. A young Labrador recently died after being left in a cage dryer for half an hour set at 100 degrees. A Shih Tzu and two Yorkshire Terriers also died at salons where dryers failed to switch off. You could always opt to stay with your pet while he is groomed, but at the very least it's worth checking out the groomer's qualifications and consulting other customers for references.
A favourite pastime of humans is a summer barbecue, but it may not be good for Fido. Dogs can burn themselves on hot barbecues and can suffer food poisoning from eating leftovers that don't agree with them. A common accompaniment to the barbecue is corn on the cob, but the hard central core is indigestible and is just one of the foreign bodies veterinarians report having to remove from dogs' intestines.
Dogs love to feel the wind in their fur as they travel in a car. But dogs travelling in the back of pickup trucks can have their paws burned if the metal heats up in the sun. They also risk being thrown out of the vehicle, and using a harness in that situation can add the danger of strangulation. However, for dogs travelling inside a truck, a harness is a must. When a Louisiana driver crashed this summer, his dog was inside the truck but was unrestrained and died in the crash, while the seatbelt-wearing owner sustained only minor injuries.
Finally, a word of warning that even toys can be dangerous. A dog called Chai recently had to have a rubber ball cut off after it got stuck on his tongue. Chai has been through a terrible ordeal, suffering pain and difficulty eating and drinking. You can read his story at thechaistory.blogspot.com, where you can also find out how to support the campaign to have this design of ball withdrawn.
It's reassuring that for most of our dogs, summer is a happy time, but it's better to be safe than sorry. And if you know of any dangers we haven't covered, do let us know. That's all from us today on the Dogcast Radio News Desk. Goodbye.
Oh, what is the matter with poor Puggywug? Pet him and kiss him and give him a hug. Run and fetch him a suitable drug. Wrap him up tenderly all in a rug. That is the way to cure Puggywug. Winston Churchill on his daughter Mary's pet pug. I've been contacted on behalf of Lulu and Lolly, two Malteses and celebrity dogs, who are putting a positive face on pet adoption and rescue shelters. You can check out their website at www.luluandlolly.com. Last month, Lulu and Lolly and their owner, Cynthia Miller, launched their first music video on YouTube called Rescue Dog Rock, and there's a link to it on the Dogcast Radio site. The video is proving popular, and Cynthia, an advertising and marketing expert and devout animal lover from Austin, Texas, believes there are a lot of people not paying attention to pet rescue issues because we don't talk about them in a happy way. After scooping up Lolly, a malnourished Maltese, from a shelter, Cynthia committed herself to trying to do something to change the way people talk about rescue animals. She was also tired of heartbreaking, sad images and ads about adopting pets, so she decided to take this different approach. We also have a link on the Dogcast Radio site to the New Orleans Times-Picayune, which ran an article about Lulu and Lolly's efforts, and how a portion of the sales from their online calendar and other products have benefited Animal Rescue New Orleans in the wake of the third anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. This is a great positive way to think of rescue dogs, rather than focusing on the sad stories that landed the dogs in shelters in the first place. Rock on, Lulu and Lolly. In finding today's poetry quotes, I came across this beautiful one from Elizabeth Barrett Browning, "To Flush My Dog." Therefore to this dog will I, tenderly, not scornfully, render praise and favour. With my hand upon his head is my benediction said, therefore and for ever. And to finish off our poetry theme, as J. Allen Boone said, my idea of good poetry is any dog doing anything. Till next time, look after yourselves and your dogs.
Thanks for listening to Dogcast Radio, available from www.dogcastradio.com. That's dogcastradio.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, and wherever you are in the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so in a variety of ways. By phone from the UK, you can contact us on 0121 288
0922. From the US, you can contact us on our American number, which is 315-849-2022. From any other country, you'll need your international exit code and then 44121-288-0922. You can contact us on Skype with the ident Dogcast Radio. That's all one word, Dogcast Radio. By email, you can contact me on julie@dogcastradio.com. When contacting us by email, if you have the facilities, please record your questions or comments and send them to us as an audio file. That way we can include them directly in our programme. We can accept most formats, for example, WAV, MP3. All these methods of contacting us can be found on our website, which is www.dogcastradio.com. And as ever, the final word goes to Jenny.
What do you get if you cross a dog with a frog? A dog that can lick you from the other side of the road.